Welcome to Chew the Fat. I'm Craig Hartman, your host for a time where we'll have food conversation. We hope that this conversation will be something extremely interesting. We hope to cut through the public persona of chefs, foodies, food bloggers, restaurant owners, winemakers, etc. What we really want to know is what really drives one to excel in a food-related art. And you know what? We'll try to see what patterns arise that binds all these folks together, and hopefully it'll be an inspiration to you as it has been to me. Tonight, we're lucky enough to have one of the finest female chefs in the entire United States, and finest chefs, male or female. Her name is Melissa Hart, and I'm lucky enough to have worked with her for several years at Clifton Inn and also the Cliff House in Manitou Springs, Colorado, and she has a deep history in food. She worked with some fantastic chefs. She's from Alabama, and we're going to start off tonight, you know, asking her a few questions about her background. And so, Melissa, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing. Actually, this is a really fantastic day for me. And why don't you tell us first some of the places, kind of like a mini bio of yourself.
Wow, mini bio. I've worked restaurants since I was about 15, a predominant fast food joint when I was 15. Did that through high school. When I went off to college, worked a barbecue restaurant.
Nice.
A short order cook. And then moved up into a full service restaurant, put myself through school, decided after becoming a school teacher, that I was a much better cook than a school teacher.
So I don't know how you wouldn't be a good school teacher.
Well, let's say I'm just better with food than I am children. But anyway, ended up going back to school, worked for Frank Stitt for a little while at Bottega in Birmingham, Alabama. Then decided at 27 to go to culinary school and went to New England Culinary Institute. Did my first internship at the Clifton Inn with yours truly.
That was a fun time, wasn't it?
That was a fun time. Long time ago.
We won't talk about that time in this interview. No, I'm just kidding.
Did my second internship at Rose Pistola in San Francisco, where I enjoyed San Francisco. But once again, you came back into my life and offered me an executive sous chef position at the Cliff House in Colorado and was there for, what, 2.5 years, I think?
Yeah, I think that's about right.
And then got the opportunity to move here in 2000 to be the chef at Palladio Restaurant. I've been there ever since.
And the rest is history.
The rest is history.
So you also are married and have a great husband and son. Just tell us a little bit about them.
I've been married a little over a year now to Matthew Hart, who is also a chef. Got a son in the bargain, 8-year-old Jacob, who is the light of my life. And it's nice to be a mom.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I've never seen you this happy before in my life.
It's good.
We've always known you as a happy person, but now you're extremely happy.
Oh, thank you.
How was that? It's really funny to think back. You know, I had the good opportunity to have you as an intern at Clifton Inn, and that was a very interesting time. Clifton was kind of a magical place back then, and you had to live there at Clifton Inn.
I did.
And
I had
a curfew because
28 years old.
And you would have to be there. And I remember that was the only thing, you know, you did so well at that. Other interns did not do really well. Mm-hmm. But when they would come home late, you know, my wife and I would be sitting out on the porch waiting for them. It must have been a terrible time. And then we opened the Cliff House together, which was for most chefs who've never done an opening, or for anybody who's never opened a restaurant or a hotel, it's one of the most excruciating and stressful experiences
physically and emotionally.
And but it makes for some great stories. I'm very thankful that I've had some time with you, and but I'm ready to start asking you some questions so we can delve. We can chew right through the fat, right?
All right.
And delve into your heart. Wow, isn't that funny?
That is.
So hard. I didn't mean that like that. Okay, here we go. You know, Melissa, you've had some unbelievable success. And I just want to know, what exactly do you think about that? How do you feel about your success?
You know, it's I almost don't. I mean, I know I'm successful. Don't get me wrong. I know that. But it's just that every day is a little bit better. And I've always strived in everything I've done to do better the next day than I did the day before. So after 10 years at a restaurant, you know, it's hard not to succeed if you live by that philosophy. And I've been backed by a great staff, too, over the years. I've had some incredible sous chefs and some great interns and not so great interns. And, you know, but, you know, you just wake up one day and you realize you've accomplished things that you put your mind to 10 years ago, and it feels good.
I know it's got to feel good, but, you know, we look at chefs, and the public looks at chefs. They see chefs in magazines. They see chefs on television. And they're always wondering, you know, what are they thinking? How do they actually feel about themselves? Do they, because sometimes on TV they show themselves as a little bit on the pompous side, but lots of times that's because there's a show that's a competition or, you know, a throwdown with Bobby Flay. But, you know, I'm interested to know whether a chef actually feels successful when they are successful or if they feel like they've only just begun.
I think it's a little bit of both. Of course, it's to know you succeeded. You know, some of the goals that I've reached, I'm very proud of. And it's, you know, it makes me feel good to stand there and, you know, know that I've gotten the semifinalist for James Beard Award. That means a lot to me. I've gotten lucky that I haven't worked with a lot of those pompous chefs. And maybe they all are just the public persona. I don't know. I haven't met them. But I've never looked at things in life with that kind of attitude. Yeah. And just, I kind of accept my successes and hope to build on them for a new success.
Well, you know, I think the public looks at chefs these days because they love food so much, and it's very interesting. And everybody has food-related experiences. So, you know, if they're talking to an actor or they're talking to someone else in the public, they may not be able to relate at mm-hmm. all, but everybody can relate with food. And I think everybody inside would love to be, you know, have something to do with that. So it's interesting for people to know, well, you know, here's a person like yourself who has been a runner up for the James Beard Award. You've been in many magazines. Your restaurant has been called one of the top five wine or vineyard restaurants in the world, things like that. It's just interesting for people to say, you know, what is really behind that? I have another question. What do you, you know, in your upbringing in Alabama, I've met your parents. They're really some of the sweetest people I have ever met in my life. But can you pinpoint anything, like one thing that had an impact on becoming a chef? I know you became a teacher first and you worked in some places, but is there something in your background, a grandmother who just made the world's greatest biscuits?
I think everyone in my family, being from the Deep South, you know, cooking is very much part of life in the Deep South. And I know that's true for just about every culture and every region. But in the Deep South, it's almost a religion. You know, when you had family dinner, it was family dinner. You know, it was grandma and grandpa and aunts and uncles and cousins, or, you know, going to my great aunt's church once a month, and they'd have the Sunday right after church was the big picnic out in the churchyard. And, you know, there's 100 people there and probably related to about half of them.
Nice.
But, you know, so food was always part of my life. And my mother, growing up very poor in the Deep South, they mm-hmm. cooked everything from scratch. Everything was used. There wasn't much, you know, prefab food or fancy food. So, you know, my grandmother, who I never got a chance to meet, but she'd open the door, pick out what was in the garden, bring it in, cook it simply as she could and serve her family. And my mom cooked that way. My mom never cooked by a recipe. Everything was made from scratch. And that's just what I grew up around. Mom jokes that she doesn't know how I learned to cook, because we were latchkey kids. Both my parents worked. But we had a home-cooked meal every day on the table. And Mom would come home from work at 5:15. By 6 o'clock, dinner was on the table. And so I watched
her. Aren't moms unbelievable like that?
You know, and I watched my mom vicariously over, you know, over the, sitting on the other side of the counter, and watched how she cooked. And my cooking style now, I don't use a recipe much, you know, pastries and different things. And, you know, of course, get inspiration from recipes. But I don't cook much by recipe. And I got that from my mother. And just also the attitude of, you know, what's in the garden? What can you just go out and grab and serve, honoring that product, whether it's a head of kale or a cucumber or a tomato or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I think that's what led me into Italian cuisine, because they're very much in the same philosophy. Every time I go to Italy, you know, what's being served in the restaurant's usually brought in by a basket by some man that just came off the mountain picking it. So it's very similar, different products, different tastes, and different combinations of flavors, but the same philosophy in the food.
Yeah, cool. You know, I always wondered this question before, because I always felt that it, as a child, if someone grew up eating Cheetos and, you know, macaroni and cheese out of a box or canned products, that they may not make a good chef.
I ate a lot of that growing up, too.
See, so I'm looking for the person that's going to debunk my theories. But so where were you working when you had kind of your aha moment, you know, where you thought, you know what, darn it, I'm going to chef school. I'm going to be a chef.
Well, I was, I know exactly the moment, working at Bottega Cafe in Birmingham, Alabama. I just actually recently gotten divorced from my first husband. Was kind of in that, what am I going to do state? New teaching was not, didn't make me happy. And I was working at Bottega to pay the bills. And also, I'd always kind of been the black sheep, strange kid in my family. You know, wanted to be the artistic one, wore the funny clothes, hung out with the artsy kids, but no rhythm, tone deaf, can't draw, can't sing.
Can't whistle.
Thanks. But, you know, and then my whole family's artistic, but they all used it in different ways. My dad and my brother are engineers, you know, but they can both draw. They could paint the Mona Lisa if they wanted to. And my mother's the same way, but they direct it in different fashions, not necessarily artistically. But I was standing in Bottega, plated a plate of chicken scallopini with polenta and braised greens. Everything went on the plate perfectly. There wasn't a drop. There wasn't a smear. There was no rim to wipe. Everything was perfect.
Right.
And it really was kind of that angels in the head, the aha, the lights got brighter. There was a ringing in my ears. And I was like, this is what I'm supposed to do for the rest of my life. And that's the day I decided to go to culinary school.
That's really awesome. So had you picked this school?
I kind of had, just because I'd already had friends that had gone to school there. In fact, my roommate in Birmingham was back doing his first internship from New England Culinary. And I looked at the other schools, but they really do have a great program, hands-on, small classes. At that time, not so much now, but back then the classes were a little bit older. The average age was closer to 30, which I was 27 at the time, and that appealed to me because, you know, these people had worked in the business before. So it was going and continuing my education, not starting from how to peel a potato, which I've been doing for 10 years at that point.
But so, a darn good potato peeler.
I am. As anybody. So.
Well, let me ask you, you went to the school, you know, a lot of people go to chef school. And now there's hundreds and hundreds of culinary schools out there. And I don't know, maybe a million people in culinary schools now. It's probably not that many. Well, how about 100,000?
It's got to be a lot.
It's a lot, yeah. So, folks, we're not really making a real number, so don't take this seriously. But there is a lot of people in culinary school. But some of the trends say that 4 out of 5 after, you know, 3 or 4 years are no longer in the business. And we know, you and I both know, it's very stressful. It's a lot of hours and a lot of sacrifice. What do you think is the kind of one attribute that sets you apart from other chefs to be able to not fail? And I'm not saying failing, because even these people don't fail. They just realize, you know, maybe this isn't for them. But there's got to be something inside of you that says, look, I work these hours. And I've seen you work a few hours.
A few 110-plus-hour weeks.
But what is it? Why didn't you walk away? Why are you still here?
Because I'm good at what I do, and I love what I do. And, you know, I think kind of what you're talking about here, the food networks and things, I think, have done amazing things for our business, and I think they've done a few detrimental things. I think that it has glorified being a chef. It has kind of given it this royalty stance, which think we work hard enough, we deserve it. But you now have a bunch of kids that are going into culinary school that have never worked in the business, don't right. know that I'm never going to have a Friday or Saturday night off ever. I don't won't ever be home for Christmas. I won't be home for New Year's Eve. I won't kiss my boyfriend or girlfriend or wife or husband on, you know, New Year's Eve. I'll miss most of my friends' weddings. I won't see my brother's kids born. You know, it's just a sacrifice you make. And I don't think that you don't see that in the Food Network channels and stuff. And I think to be good at what you do, you have to love to do it. And, you know, you have to love this business to stay in this business for all those reasons. And then once you finally get to a level and you can say, well, I'm taking that weekend off because my brother's getting married or whatever, you finally do achieve that.
The level
that where you can, right. you can step away and you have people you trust that can run your kitchen the way you want it to be run. And, but what's inside me that makes me do that? I'm not 100% sure, you know. I mean, I guess that's kind of the question in anybody's life. What makes you do what you want to do? And I know you don't stay in this business if you don't love it, and you'll never succeed in it. And I just have a passion and a love for cooking food, making people happy.
And that I've seen firsthand. But let me ask you, tell folks that will listen to this particular conversation, what does it take to do your job? Now, before you answer this question, Melissa's the chef at Palladio Restaurant at Barbersville Vineyards, which is arguably the best vineyard winery east of the Mississippi. And it has international recognition, being owned by the Zonin family, family from Gambolara, Italy. They are extremely well-known in Italy for their wine industry. And over here, they've done fantastic things. People on the outside would look at this, and I know, and say, God, if I could just be a vineyard chef at such a great vineyard, you know, this would be the greatest thing that could ever happen to me. And, but take people through, what does it really take to do what you do on a daily basis?
Well, you know, I do, have some great opportunities at the vineyard. You know, we have a gardener there, so he grows food, but, and you know, so we have a lot of things that are brought to us that are high quality, and kind of going back to what I was saying, the simplicity of our food, there's not too much crazy work that we have to do. We don't do a lot of the molecular gastronomy. We don't do a lot of fooling around with the food, but at the same time, we make everything fresh. And in a single day, today, in fact, we made two types of bread. I made two different desserts. We started a salami. So there's all these processes that go on starting in the beginning of the week that won't even come to fruition, sometimes for 2 days, 4 days, or even 6 weeks with a salami. So you're constantly having to stay ahead of the game, and there's every plate has so much work into it because everything's made from scratch, you know, whether it's the pasta or the breads or our braises or anything. So there's always work to be done, and it's a labor of love.
What about the other things that people don't think about? So you're recruiting, right?
Yeah.
You're always recruiting because you have interns that you know are leaving on a certain date.
Yeah, there's always the clipboard side of being the chef.
Yeah.
You know, you have to do your orders. You have to check in orders. You have, you know, when we come in on Wednesday, we're closed on Monday and Tuesday. So we get almost all our product is there at the front door when we walk in at 9 o'clock. So you spend an hour and a half of just putting stuff in the walk-in, putting it in the storage room and making sure everything's neat and clean, put up right, cause, or you'll drive your chef's OCD crazy, which would be mine. And then there's also, you know, answering the phone calls. I mean, I've had days where I've put my apron on, picked my knife up 20 times before I've actually cut anything.
Right.
Because the phone rings or somebody shows up or a new farmer stops by or the, you know, and all of a sudden you look up and 2 hours are gone and you haven't started the mousse that's supposed to be ready in another hour.
Right.
And so there's always that side of the executive part of being the chef, too, that can take out a lot more hours than people think.
True. Now, You're a big time chef now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you sweep the floor?
I do.
And mop? Do you mop?
I do. I'm mopping very rarely anymore, but I do sweep.
So you've graduated.
You're
past the mopping stage.
I haven't taken the trash out in a long time.
Yeah,
but that's
yeah.
what the boys are for.
Yeah, true enough. So, you know, because I think it's interesting for people to say, you know, here's a chef, and it's cool. I mean, really, it is cool. I think being the chef at Palladio is pretty cool. And, you know, because I love Luca and I love vineyards. And come on, you get to walk outside and look at that.
I have the greatest office in the world.
The view of the vineyards is fantastic. So quality of life. I like when people say that to me as a chef. The quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
Here you are at these beautiful places. And you know what? There is a lot to be thankful for. So I think you should be thankful for that particular view. And we're going to speak more to that in a little. Tell me, do you think there's an attribute internally speaking, like inside, that sets you apart from other chefs? And then I'm going to ask you also, do you think that you're better than a lot of other chefs? It's a funny question, but let's think about what actually sets one chef apart from the other. And we know. We know that there's many restaurants in our area and other areas that have some fantastic people that never get any nod, but those people are there every day working hard. So I'm not saying this to make anyone upset. I just really want to know what makes someone drive on the inside. Are they working to become better at their art? Do they, you know, I mean, is there something inside you that I can link to other chefs down the road that you think is maybe like a gift or something inside?
Well, I think that for me personally, I think what makes me be a better chef and succeed at what I do is the love of the food and the love of presenting the food properly. I've got my own style of cooking, and I stay with what I know, and I think that helps to succeed. I think in any industry, whether it's this business or another, sometimes you can think a little too far out of the box and you get away from your skills that are good, and that's going to end up being detrimental to your final product. I just strive to present the food the best I can, and I think that, you know, am I better than any other chefs? I don't know. I mean, that's, you know, me and well enough. I don't judge myself up against other people.
But I'm trying to get you to.
I know you are. You're probably not going to succeed.
No, but what I'm thinking is, honestly, you go in and you make food, but you don't just make food, right?
I love food, so that's
you look at the ingredients and then you say, you know, this is what I'm going to serve. This is how it relates to Palladio and Barbersville.
So
there's a lot of little things that I think sometimes people in our industry, they don't see what goes on.
I think that I've been very lucky at Palladio because Italian food is something I've always loved to do. And then being able to be surrounded by Italians and being able to have the freedom to create Italian food with my twist on it. And I think staying with what I know is probably one of my better attributes, and just focusing on this cuisine. And I love to cook other cuisines, and I cook a lot of other cuisines out of the house, and you know, Matthew does many other cuisines.
Sure.
I think my success personally has come from just that focus of knowing where my limits are, mm-hmm. knowing that this is the best, this is the food that I create the best, and this is what's going to make my customers happiest.
Right. So are you ever happy with what you make? I mean, really happy?
Of
do you
course.
Ever think, my God, this is unbelievable?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And so how do you come up with some of these combinations? I mean, do you, like, for instance, myself, sometimes I'm taking a shower and I come up with, there's something about being relaxed in the shower. I just like, oh my God, I just had this moment.
There's definitely, they're my bedtime moments. You know, there's usually when I'm waking up in the morning, laying there, not quite awake, and I'll have some inspiration or been thinking about a dish and how can we plate it, or how can we, you know, like wanting to run flank steak in a fancy restaurant. How do you cook it and plate it to where it looks nice, and you also don't have to cook a whole flank because you how many orders are you going to get? You know, and then all of a sudden having this flash of, wait, why don't I cut it thin and roll it like look like a filet
right.
and cook them? And those kind of, you know, I'm sure somebody else has done it. Maybe I saw it in a magazine and it was in my subconscious. But, you know, I have those moments. I get my inspiration from my staff. Mm-hmm. We do change the menu every 2 months, and I love for my staff to have ownership of their plates. We switch stations every 2 months, so everybody knows how to do everything. And We sit down with a bottle of wine on a Sunday and or go out
See,
to dinner.
See, now we're down. Now we figured it out.
You know, we sit down, we go out to lunch or dinner somewhere outside of our restaurant, sit there with a notebook, and I make a list of what's coming in season in the next 2 months. And then we go backwards from there. It's like, oh, chanterelles are coming in. How can we best express this chanterelle to the public?
Right.
And then we'll create dishes that way. And so we're bouncing, you know, bounce ideas off each other. And of course, I'll sit in Barnes and Nobles and flip through books and look at pictures or sure. look through magazines. There's many places to get, you know, as far as eating at other restaurants.
Are you consumed by it? Do you think about it like 24/7?
No, I've learned to turn it off. I think you have to, you know, after 20 years in the business now, you know, 15, you get... I guess
what? It's got to be close.
20.
you first worked for me.
25 years.
I'm going backwards.
25 years. You know, you do get all consumed with it there for a while. You know, you can't go out to eat at a restaurant without picking it apart. You can't go to bed without dreaming about food. You can't, God forbid, go to sleep without hearing the ticket machine going off in your head. And you have to learn to let it go, because to stay in this business for any amount of time, you have to find a respite from it.
And it's
even True harder enough. With being married to a chef. It's easier in a lot of ways, because we understand each other's psychosis and we have the same hours and we can bounce ideas off of each other. But sometimes we both just look at each other and like, stop talking about food. Don't talk about the restaurant.
Yeah.
From this point till we go to sleep, there is no food talk. And I'm sure you and Donna have the same thing with working in the business together, but I've learned to turn it off. And very happily so sometimes.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, you know, I always tell people, look, this is a marathon, not a sprint, when they first get in the business. And, you know, I've seen a lot of sprinters come in and they're not around anymore.
They don't last more than 10 years.
So if you had, you know, thinking about the culinary climate in the world, all the trends and everything, is there something that excites you that's happening right now?
You know, I think all kinds of new things excite me to experience, you know, and I think as a chef, going back to knowing what my strengths and weaknesses are, there's a lot of cuisines I would not want to cook, you know, it's not,
sure.
you know, especially a lot of this molecular gastronomy that's coming out. I think it's fun. I think it's interesting. It's like, I'd love to go experience it, but it's not something I can do day in and day out for myself. It's not my philosophy of food. But, you know, being in the business for 25 years, watching the cycles, and one of the best movements being the local movement that,
right.
you know, I was out in San Francisco. It was several years after Alice Waters, but it was really kind of the beginning of the tidal wave of all the local movement, and watching it just take over the country is amazing. And even in 10 years I've been in Charlottesville, you know, I started with one farmer.
Sure.
9 years ago, came to the back door with some Sweet 100 tomatoes. And then within 5 years, you have 20 farmers calling you up. I got tomatoes.
Right.
And you're almost over inundated, but it's great. And, you know, I love that kind of stuff. And I just love new stuff. You know, anytime a new restaurant opens, you know, I wait a month, let them get the kinks out. And then I go and eat, because I just love eating new stuff. And
True. Well, look, it's 20 years, 25 years, whatever it is. Do you worry that somewhere along the line you're not going to be able to stay fresh and exciting? I mean, or is there something? Because I remember when I was a young chef, I would see these chefs that were my age now, and they were totally stuck in whatever year it was and wouldn't change. And I always said to myself, if this happens to me, I'm done. You know, do you ever feel that way?
Yeah. And, you know, I think what I help to keep that away from entering my life is I do have interns. I sit on the committee, a program advisory committee at New England Culinary Institute. So I'm highly involved in the culinary school. I always have an intern. So I have two interns a year. And it's always kind of keeping a thumb on the pulse of what is new, and keeping an 18, 22, 25-year-old kid that wants to come in and learn and just wants to see new things, but is also reading all these books that I probably would never pick up, and bringing in ideas and wanting to try something. And so it always keeps a nice climate of learning in the kitchen.
Sure. Sure, I think surrounding yourself with young people in the kitchen is a good thing. I like it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It keeps me kind of fresh as I can be these days. Anyway, how about, is there anything that upsets you about culinary trends? Anything that, like, you just can't, you just don't understand?
I think with culinary trends themselves, no, you know, I think some of the molecular stuff's getting a little out of hand sometimes. You know, I want to eat real food. I don't want to just smell it.
You don't sprinkle Pop Rocks on some of your desserts or anything like that?
No, yeah, I don't. But, you know, and that's...
You know, they outlawed those things back in the day.
They
did. Back.
When I was a kid, yeah, I remember them because they would burst in your mouth really bad. I think there's a new formula, I'm sure.
Yeah, probably.
But, you know, I think what kind of bugs me with being involved with a culinary school is a lot of the young kids going to school that haven't picked up a knife before they go, and expecting to come out and be the next Bobby Flay and expect to go on an internship and rule the world, or, you know, walk away and, oh, well, I just finished my second year of culinary school. Where's my executive chef job? And,
right.
You know, that trend bugs me.
What do you think of that title anyway? Executive.
Yeah. I kind of like it. I am a cook at heart, but it's nice to be.
I remember I walked in a kitchen one time with a briefcase because I was the executive chef. There was nothing in it, but I thought, darn it, this is going to be cool. I'm the executive chef. Someone asked me, what's in there? I said, don't ask. I'm the executive chef.
It's like the repo man, Trump.
True. Hey, so, all right. So you get these young people. What is the advice? You know, let's say we have some listeners who are thinking about becoming chefs. What would you tell them, you know, about something, some wisdom? Because, you know, you think, you know, 20-some years, you have some wisdom in there.
I think the best thing to have if you want to succeed in this business is knowing that you don't know everything and be willing to learn from anybody. And to have stamina and a good pair of shoes.
Stamina and a good pair of shoes. You know what, I can attest to that. That's another story. But what's your favorite meal of all time?
Favorite meal of all times. It's kind of always changing. I tell you, I think, I'll give you the first, like maybe the top three. One of which was, I started working at Palladio in October of 2000.
Right.
And I think it was November, late October, early November. Luca, who, for those of you who are listening, is our winemaker at the vineyard and my immediate boss. His brother owns a restaurant in Alba in Piedmont, which is famous for the white truffles.
Sure.
And, you know, at this time I thought I'd had truffles before, and, you know, I'd seen a fresh truffle here and there. But Luca comes in, he's like, I'm cooking staff meal today. I'm like, okay. Yeah, I've been working there for 3 weeks.
Sure.
I didn't
yeah.
quite know how to handle this. So Luca has a big pot of polenta on. Stirs probably 3 pounds of St. Andre's cheese into the polenta, puts it in a bowl, and shaves a fresh white truffle that Diego, his brother, had sent. Good quarter of an inch thick of just paper-thin slices of white truffle, and pours a Barolo from his hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And as simple as it is, you're talking ground corn, salt, water, cheese, and truffles. 4 ingredients.
Yeah.
And it was one of the best meals I've ever put in my mouth. And it just, it that right there showed me the simplicity of Italian food and how to enjoy a real
yeah.
truffle.
Oh, man. That's it. I'm done. No, actually, you know what is funny? One of my top meals is from Luca also. And it was a harvest dinner that he cooked for the staff in August when I was at his house. And they all sat outside of his house. And he just made the most simple pappardelle with fresh tomatoes and olive oil and garlic and fresh bread and wine. So, you know, and there's something magical about it.
It really is.
And, well, cool. Okay, so here's the final question. I'm going to talk about where do you go from here, but you see, you went truffle hunting.
I did. I got a chance to go
so
truffle hunting.
So what
January.
Else is left? I mean, there's nothing left. Are you done? Is that it? Are you retiring next? I mean, you went truffle hunting. What is left for you? What is left for you?
There's a lot left for me. You know, I love working for the Zonin family and at Barbersville. But, you know, being married to Chef now, I mean, we definitely have high hopes and aspirations of owning our own restaurant. And, you know, collaborating with a spouse, you know, can be, could either be the best thing in the world.
I've done it for like 18 or 20 years.
You know, best thing in the world or the worst thing in the world.
But you got a leg up. Yeah. The woman will always be the boss. You heard it here on Chew the Fat.
And you know, I think Matthew and I would have a very successful restaurant. We're different types of chefs. We definitely, our yin and yangs fit very well. And he keeps me sane and he puts up with my craziness. And you know, same goes for him with me. And that's a hope and dream. You know, I'm very happy at Palladio. And, yeah, but, you know, when the opportunity strikes, I'd like to open up a restaurant.
Well, you know, if that happens, I'm sure that there's about a million listeners, if they listen. There's that many that would like to. Would like to take your place because that is, you know, it's a fantastic place. And I know that you've been blessed being there because, you know, you do get to smell that air and it's inspiring, isn't it?
It really is. And, you know, and it's a great job. It's a, you know, one of the best chef schedules in the world. And I do get the opportunity to, Luca's very good with us about as long as we're using a great product, you know, he doesn't want mediocre products. So, you know, I get the best of the local rabbits and chickens and eggs. And, you know, and if we need to spend $1,200 on a truffle, we can spend $1,200 on a truffle. I got to make it up elsewhere. You know, it's not, there's definitely not a bottomless pocket to pick it from. But I get the opportunity to work with great products that a lot of chefs don't get an opportunity to do because food cost is definitely a high priority in restaurants.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
Well, cares,
this
right?
is coming to me talking to you. 22 quarts of truffle vinaigrette.
I've been known to blow the food costs a few times. But, well, Melissa, I just want to thank you for being the first interviewee. I'm the
You're the
E, right?
Exactly.
On Chew the Fat.
Oh, and, it's been my pleasure, Craig, as always.
I know you're going to have that restaurant one day.
One day.
I'm going to be the first one there. Oh, sitting down.
Definitely.
And eating.
Yes.
You'll probably have me in the back, though, yelling at me, come on. But anyway, so it's been great, and I hope to talk to you soon.
Definitely.
Folks, you've been listening to Chew the Fat with Craig Hartman. I hope that you've enjoyed today's segment. We have a website, chewfat.net. It's chewfat.net. Please go on there if you have any questions. You know, we can do follow-up questions with Chef Melissa. We can do follow-up questions to any of the interviewees that we've had. If you have any future questions that you think you'd like to hear from any chef or any of the folks that I have on, you know, please feel free to go on chewfat.net and write the questions down. If you liked the podcast, go on there and let us know. If you didn't like it, stay away. Oh, just kidding. If you didn't like it, go on there. Tell us what you think would make it better. Our goal is to just have interesting conversation that, you know, when you're on there, will just inspire you and maybe make you angry, too. And if we're invoking any kind of emotion in you when it comes to food, then we think that we're doing our job. So go to chewfat.net, ask some questions. Give us some feedback, and if you would, tell all your friends, the people who love food. We know there's millions of foodies out there, and foodies are our friend. Again, it's Craig Hartman with Chew the Fat. Looking forward to having you listen again soon.
This decade, but I realized sometime earlier this year that it had been 26 years since this come out as a movie, and it was 2 years before that that it came out as a record, and it was 2 years ago on the record, which means it was like 30 Thanksgivings ago, 30 years ago on Thanksgiving, when my friend and I decided to go up and visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice didn't used to live in a restaurant. She used to live in the church nearby the restaurant, in the bell tower, with her husband Ray and Facha the dog, and living in the bell tower. Like